welcome to this session, Time Heals and Other Clichés. The aim of this session, discussing and talking about bereavement, is not to find answers with a capital A or solutions with a capital S. Basically, what we're going to do is going to hear the experiences of this fine panel and also to hear your experiences. And if you find something that's useful for your life, for your experience, so much the better. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing it. So basically, I'll be talking to the panel for the first half of the session, and then we'll open it up to you for your experiences or any questions that you might have. There are a couple of notepads which will be circulating, because maybe you'll feel that you actually don't want to stand up and talk about your experience or stand up and give your question, but you might want to write it down. So at about 10 minutes from the end, if I remember, the pads will come forward and I'll ask the question or your experiences on your behalf. I'll introduce the panel to you. In the brown T-shirt in the middle is Nick Battle, a writer and musician, and the founder of the Gravel Road Trust, which he founded after the death of his wife, Lynn, who battled cancer for 10 years. And Nick had two daughters with Lynn, one of whom I saw this morning.
Yeah, the other one's over there.
And he's over there with his second wife, Nikki, and young baby son.
Jesse.
There are too many names for me to remember, but I'll have a go. At the far end, we have Rachel and Pete Griffiths, who I met through my contact through Helen House. They've experienced the care at Helen House Hospice very well, because they had two daughters, Misha and Natalie, who had a degenerative illness, Batten's disease. Misha died in 2002. And Natalie the year after. And you have two other children.
We do, yeah.
And they live in Aylesbury. Not that that's relevant, but I thought I'd throw that in. Yeah. And next to me is Sister Frances Dominica, who is an Anglican nun and the founder of the Helen House Children's Hospice, the world's first. And she's a force of nature, and if you want anything done, she can sort it for you. About an hour ago, I was showing her the map about where this map was, and I said, actually, basically, you built a hospice, so I'm sure you can find your way to this tent. Now, here is Nick Cocking. And if it wasn't for Nick, we wouldn't be having this session, because this session came out of a conversation I had with Nick last year at Greenbelt about the death of his wife, Helena, who died 2 years ago. It was one of those great Greenbelt conversations where you just bump into someone, and we were probably blocking the main route between the racecourse and here. But Nick was just talking about his experiences after the death of Helena and people's attitude. And it was very much a bittersweet conversation, I think, with a lot of humour to it. But I thought we'd kick off the session. And in a way, Nick and I just replicate a bit of that conversation that we had. So, Nick, grab the microphone a little bit closer to you. What sort of reactions did you get from friends and family? Well, I mean, what reactions have you had over the past 2 years when people have spoken to you about, when they've said, how are you?
Okay. Can I go back a few years and go back to the beginning of my exposure to bereavement of any sort? And this may sound bizarre, but I just want to go back to the death of Lady Di in the 1990s. Now, I had no interest whatsoever in Lady Di, but you remember there was some sort of wave of emotion went out across the nation when she died. I don't think it was grief, because none of us knew her, but something happened. And what I remember was, in the media at the time, a lot of commentators said that this would be a watershed in the life of the nation and the way that we deal with death. From then on, we would be able to talk about death and bereavement and difficult feelings. We'd become a more sort of touchy-feely nation. So I suppose I had high expectations after that. My balloon was very soon burst a few years later when my father died. And I remember telling a neighbour about his death. And his first reaction was, my father was an evil bastard, I hated his guts. So I guess he wasn't one of the people at Kensington Palace with flowers. I certainly didn't see him there. Then, a few years after that, 2007, my lovely wife Helena took her own life after a long battle with depression. I'm not going to talk much about suicide today, because that's not the purpose of this panel. If anybody wants to talk about that personally afterwards, feel free to approach me. I think the first thing I found when she died, and people used to come around or pass me in the street, was that they found it extremely difficult, not just death itself, but suicide, which raises lots of other issues. And they sort of stratified themselves into people who could engage with it and people who couldn't very, very quickly.
And what sort of comments did you get? Because I know you had a particular your domestic situation in the living room, you could tell what sort of conversation you're going to have by where they actually sat on your sofa, isn't that right?
Yeah, they stream themselves automatically. In my living room, I've got two sofas at right angles, and a great queue of people came to the house, which is fantastic, friends and family and well-wishers, and I could tell from which sofa they sat on how they were going to react to me. I tend to sit at one end of one of the sofas, the comfy one, and they would come through the gap between them, and they would either come and sit next to me or they would go and sit on the other sofa. Now, if they came and sat next to me, they were physically close to me, and they would immediately engage with what I was going through, and they were there to put an arm around me, to hug me, to cry with me, really engage with me. If they went and sat on the other sofa, they tended to fold their arms or put their hands in their lap and say, right, have you got rid of her stuff yet? Time heals, which is why we're here today, and lots of other cliches, which I'm sure we'll touch on.
And the other Nick... What sort of comments have you had over the years?
One classic one when Lynn was very poorly and she fought breast cancer for 10 years, was walking into church one day and somebody came up to me going, "Hi, how are you?" And the real answer to that question was, if you really knew me, you'd know the answer. And I just remember bursting into tears and going to one of our wardens, who's going to look after us? And he went, "We will." But actually, I just wanted to slap that person at the time. And I think the thing is that if in doubt, say nothing. You know, pray for them. Walk alongside these people. If in doubt, say nothing.
Pete and Rachel, what would you say?
I think one of the first comments we had, I think in a Christian environment, there's that perhaps misconception that, okay, we're Christians, our children have gone to a better place, they're out of pain. And we have two other children, and one of the comments we had was, "Well, it's okay, you know, you've got two others." And that makes it all better, obviously. So I think the other thing that is the cliche, it's, okay, are you moving on? Have you moved on yet? And you never move on. You learn to adapt. But every day, some days are like the first day our daughter's died. And that's the reality of it. So
it's almost like you carry the emotional scar on you. You mustn't let it hold you back or cripple you spiritually or emotionally, because that would be such a waste of time. C.S. Lewis says, "Don't waste your sorrows," doesn't he? And just to try and turn what has happened into good, but not to be crippled by what's happened, but to acknowledge it's actually made us who we are now.
And Francis, why do you think, as a society, we are so uncomfortable talking about death and dying? Why do so many people say the wrong thing?
I suppose cultures change over the centuries, don't they? And at the moment, death is still, whatever we like to think, it's still taboo. We're still uncomfortable with it. I was talking earlier on this afternoon to somebody who works in hospice, adult hospice, in the United States. And he said, "You have no idea how much worse it is there. You know, every effort is made to grow younger rather than older and to pretend that we're never going to die. And the thing about, you know, going into the deep freeze when you die, in case at some stage somebody invents something, which if you're thawed, you know, you'll have more life to live." And it's an extraordinary phenomenon, it seems to me, that St. Paul says, doesn't he? "We of all people are most to be pitied. If for this life only we have hoped, we of all people are most to be pitied." And, you know, that is our Christian belief, that God has given us life now, but for whatever reason, life ends sooner or later. But we do believe that there is life, the fullness of life, the other side of death. That no way takes away from the pain of those who are left behind, I think. But I don't know. I think it's something that we really, really, as Christians, need to work at. You can sow a seed here and there, can't you? You know, nothing happens in a big way. Jesus didn't work in a big way. He actually taught people in twos and threes and fives and little groups. He didn't, as I said in my last session, you know, if I were God, I'd have waited to be incarnate until there was jet travel and mass media. You know, how useful it would have been. But actually, God didn't wait. God just worked with a few pretty untrustworthy people. And that belief has been handed down through the centuries. And we have, as our calling, to hand it on to others and to say, yes, death is painful beyond words, but there is actually under it all, there is hope, somehow. But in the meantime, we need people who will journey with us. It's about companionship. cum panis, to share bread, that which is basic and, you know, symbolic of what we need for survival as well as nourishment. And we don't have all the answers. I think one of the ways in which, as Christians, we let people down sometimes is by pretending we have got the answers all sort of ready-made, and we don't have. God hasn't told. And a little boy of 10 who was dying once said to me, you know, we have the questions, God has the answers. Only after we die will he give us the answers.
Rachel, down the end, I wonder whether you have found, I mean, anecdotally, I hear that sometimes people cross the street rather than talk to someone who's bereaved, and friendships changed. Has that been your experience?
I've spoken to many professionals. I also work for the Child Bereavement Trust as well as at Douglas House. And lots of professionals tell me that they hear stories of people's friends crossing the street so that they don't actually have to say anything to them. And I think it's interesting that you said that it's better if you say nothing. But actually, I think we're all so different. We all need different things. And I would prefer that somebody said something to me than nothing at all. And I think that's the crux of it. If we can actually ask people, what do you need? What can I do for you? Certainly for me, it was the practical things that people did that made such a difference for me along the path of caring for my two daughters. They're the things that I remembered most. The most irritating things was not being able to keep up with your washing or doing your shopping or those sorts of things. And those are things that we can practically do for people. And as a nurse, my background's nursing, when we were training as a nurse, people said to me, you know, if you don't want people to react to you when you're acknowledging a death, just say to the person, I'm sorry for your loss, which is wonderful if you can't remember the person's name that's died, and very useful saying. But actually, when somebody said it to me, it just seemed the most crass thing ever. So if you do know the person's name, please say, I'm sorry so-and-so died. That's, you know, that's very useful.
I was just going to say, I think that word loss is probably the most misused kind of language, because I think we would all say here, we haven't lost our children, our wives, our partners, our parents. They're dead. Let's say what it is. You know, loss is something that you might find again. You change down the back of the sofa. And I think the other thing that I would say is, you never will have the right words to say. If you wait until you had the right words to say, you would never go there. And I think some of the best friends I've had, and some of them are here today, are people that will just walk the journey with us. They won't say the right words, but they will put an arm around us and say, we're here for you. They will cry with us. They will laugh with us.
Yeah, it's kind of doing the stuff in community. I had great church and great friends who would just stand by us as a family and stand by my daughters and do the life miles. It's such, you know, you can hear 1,000 sermons, but actually if someone puts their arm around you or walks you through the grief pit and out the other side, it's a very powerful thing. And the same gentleman who, when I burst into tears in church and said, who's going to look after us, when I was looking into the pit at my wife's body in the coffin, and everybody else had gone off to grieve with each other, he was the guy with his arm around me holding me up. And he continued to do so until I could walk again, really. And it's that Christ-like love in community which is so impactful, which is actually what we're told to do, isn't it? To do the stuff. Do what it says on the tin.
I think the first thing I wanted people to do most of all when they came around was just to shut up. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. People want to talk. They want to fill the silence. They want to tell you about their most recent bereavement, a bereavement in the paper, a bereavement of their chiropodist plasterer's cousin, as I used to say to my family. They just want to fill that silence. But in fact, what you want is silence, and you want them to reflect what you're going through. Weep with those who weep and mourn with those who mourn. Be silent with those who are silent. Cry with those who cry. Just reflect what you want in those early days. But people just aren't trained to do it. We're not told how to grieve. It's not on the syllabus at school.
And I guess for you, Francis, it's been a learning process for you over the years about dealing with bereaved families. Was it a very steep learning curve for you?
Well, it still is, because every family is different, and it's about just coming alongside, and as you say, just actually not saying anything. But hugs go a long way, and if you're a nun, you can hug anybody. I don't care, you know. I do think they go a long way because they say far more than words can say. But then just being there ready to... Somebody said, all I want is blotting paper. You know, just absorb what I'm feeling and what I'm saying. And it's not for nothing God gave us two ears and only one mouth. But you know, I'm the only one who's not an expert here.
So if I turn to the experts, and experts who are bereaved Christians, is there a greater expectation, do you think, from people because you're Christians, that you're going to be okay or have answers, or who wants to take that first?
That have the answers. You don't. Lynn used to say to me, you lose me, but I lose all of you. And although we had the knowledge and certainty of her going to heaven and eternal life, that didn't make it any less painful when she went. But it gave me an urgency about my mates who didn't know God. It gave me an urgency about them if I really loved them. But having answers and just because a Christian is nice and easy. No, I ranted, raged, screamed, swore at God, and on occasion still do, although I'm very happy now, thank God. God is a God of restoration and hope, always. You know, this is not a pity party here. It's a story of guys and girls standing up here by God's grace and grace of friendship and community, having done the life miles and having a hope for the future. But no, there's no easy pat answer to that one.
I think as Christians, we consider healing alongside death and disease, don't we? And there's always that question about whether if we pray hard enough or long enough or deep enough that God will heal us. And I have two experiences in my life where I've experienced both. My mum had MS, multiple sclerosis, when I was a teenager, and God healed her. She couldn't walk, she couldn't get up the stairs, all those other things. And then on the other hand, I have the comparison of losing my two children. And I really don't think that God loved me or my children or my mum any more or less than the other. But as Francis says, we'll never know the answers until we get to heaven.
I have found church probably in equal measure a place of hope, but a place of complete... loneliness too, you know, walking into church in the early days and almost, as I was sharing with these guys earlier, panic attacks. And I'm, as anybody knows me, probably the most chilled, laid-back guy going. So to have panic attacks several years after the death of my children kind of surprised me. And it was during dedications, actually, at our church where, you know, they're celebrating the birth of a new life. And actually, that's the last thing I wanted to celebrate. And, you know, we were just sharing the experience that we have lovely secretaries at our church that email me now whenever there's going to be a dedication within the church. And that just really helps. And I think it's just doing those simple things that just make all the difference, really. Just, again, showing care and love.
I suppose I'd believed all my Christian life in a wonderful God who loves us more than we know and wants the best for us. And then one day overnight, my soulmate was taken away from me. And I don't have any answers for that. I'm not saying he's a vengeful God or a God who punishes us. I just go back to the verse that says, you are the potter and we are the clay. And for me, it increases the mystery of God. His purposes are higher than ours. I'm not saying it's got a purpose. I don't know. But it makes me look up at God. What I find now is that the part of my Christian life which is private is okay, is bearable. I can go out on the hills, I scream and I rant at God and shout at God. Sometimes I shout at Helena, sometimes I get them mixed up. The public parts of it, like going to church and doing things with Christians, are harder because they've got a human element to them. I find Christians' reaction to a death and a suicide no different really to anybody else's. They're not equipped to deal with it. They don't have special skills. They're just fallible and human. And worship's difficult as well.
Quite painful up here, isn't it?
Yes.
I've come to, and everybody's journey is different, I've come to a place of reluctant faith, in as much as I've come to realise that all I hold dear in this life is a gift from God to nurture and cherish for as long as he permits. that I don't necessarily have a right to it, but I must be accountable and responsible for it. So I love my wife Nikki and my daughters Misha, Jodie, and my son Jesse, and I cherish every day I have with them. But is it mine by right? I don't know. It all belongs to God. And when, you know, I used to go into church and say, "Our Father art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. You know, your kingdom come, your will be done." You know, this rhetoric that we spout every week, it costs. It costs. And I guess, in a sense, we know that cost. And rather than throw the baby out of the bathwater and reject God and reject relationship with Jesus Christ, we seek to hold his hand through the fire and the flood to try and make sense of it all in all our brokenness. Okay? And by the grace of God, we just about, on a good day, managed to do that.
When our daughter Misha was dedicated, we were asked by our minister at the time, you know, what are you doing in this act of dedication? And we said, well, you know, our children are our gift from God, and we're giving Misha back to God. And having to do that literally has proved clearly very emotional. And again, just referring to what Nick said, there's that song that's going around at the moment, "You Give and Take Away." And that's a hard lyric to sing. But when you can sing the lyric, any of you that have gone through tough times, you know, those words mean so much more. And Psalm 23 comes to life when you've lived it, instead of it just being words on a piece of paper.
We were talking a bit before we came here, about, and you mentioned that song, but it seems to me that there are very few hymns, worship songs about death and bereavement. Do we need, you know, space for those who mourn to be part of our services? It's very easy to move into a time of worship, as they say, but what about those who don't really feel in that place? Would it be useful for you in your very different churches to have that sort of time?
I think that's quite an interesting thought, Jonathan. When we talk about the Psalms, David's Psalms, one psalm is next to another psalm and with a completely different focus. One moment, David's shouting, "Where are you, God? I can't find you. I'm in the deepest despair." And then the next psalm, he's praising God. So perhaps our worship should reflect real life in that way. And then we were talking about choices earlier on in worship. You know, we're challenged to worship in all times and all places. And actually, is that a physical choice to praise God in every circumstance? And that's quite a challenge.
Can I just pick up on something Rachel said a few minutes ago about her mother's healing and then about the girls? I remember years ago a couple coming and bringing their two children. They were preschool age and they'd just been diagnosed with a life-shortening condition, both of them. And they came to us many, many times and we grew very close to them. And then one time they came and they were really distressed. They were very committed members of their church. But one Sunday, and these two children used to take a full and active part, they became intellectually more and more disabled. So they would be singing lustily, not when everybody else was, and not the same words and so on, but never mind. They were so much a part of it. And one day, several members of the congregation said, could they talk to the parents? And what they actually said was, if you really prayed, if you had faith, your children would be well. And people sometimes say to me now, you know, have you ever had any miracles in Helen House? Like they expect that somebody's going to get up off their bed and, you know, run down the corridor and so on. But what I want to say, and I've said it so many times before, is yes, we have many, many miracles. But the miracles are the changes that come to take place in individuals, very often not the children, but those who love them, actually. And I think I'm right in saying you discover you've got gifts and graces and resources that you never dreamed you had and that you almost wish you didn't have to use or discover. So I do believe that clay and potter is a wonderful analogy. You know, God, even in the greatest dereliction, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? There, it's the clay and the potter, isn't it? And in our lives also, perhaps the times when we God is working most profoundly are the times that we would most wish we didn't have to live through.
Yeah, I think that that faith aspect is something we have to be so careful of as Christians to use that word. You know, it was said to us within members of our own church that if you just had the faith, your girls will be well. And my God isn't a God that is dependent on my faith, I believe, to make the girls well. So I think we just have to be careful about the language. The other thing I would say is I would never change, it's a bizarre thing to say, but some of the people we've come across, and Sister Frances and Jonathan, these guys today, we've met through the circumstance of the loss of our girls. So God uses every situation, and our friendships are deeper, and you know, we wouldn't have come across the hospice. And I don't know, but we are richer for the experience, if that makes sense.
I was looking through a few sort of grief and bereavement websites, which is quite eye-opening from their sensible advice, but also their crassness. I mean, there's one website, some dreadful title, I can't remember, American website, which had all sorts of advice about how to deal with people who are bereaved. And it included the advice that when you send a bereavement card, make sure you send enough postage, as if the bereaved are particularly sort of, you know, fanatical and very cross if they didn't get enough, the stamps weren't on the envelope. But on the Bupa website, it said that if you're recovering from a major bereavement, this will probably take about 1 or 2 years. And there was a lots of sort of talk as if it was a sort of scientific process, and lots of talk about the stages of grief. And I just wonder whether your experience is perhaps something, the four of you, something more chaotic than that.
Certainly in nursing, we're told about the 7 stages of grief, Kubler-Ross and lots of other bereavement theories. But actually, yes, there probably are lots of stages of grief that can be recognised, you know, anger, frustration and acceptance and all those other things. But unfortunately, they don't come in the order that you expect them. And they come back at moments that you don't expect them through stimuli that you're really not prepared for. And certainly it doesn't happen within a limited time or space. And I would say that people that I've met and spoken to, everybody has a different experience of it. I remember speaking to one mum after the girls had died, and she was a couple of years down the road, and she said, actually, I think it does get better. Those most difficult days seem further apart, but certainly my experience is that you can feel in exactly the same place as when your loss happened years and years down the line. So it doesn't take away from that depth of feeling the amount of time after the bereavement.
Yeah, just on the back of that, there was a mum who I met, Antonia Cooper, who's one of the, her husband's one of the trustees of Helen House, and I just wanted to know from her that her son had died 20 years previously. What's it like? And she said, there's some days that it's like the first day my child died. And she said, it's she put it like this, that it was like an amputee who loses an arm. They still get their phantom pains. And they will never be the same again. That person will never be the same again. They can't do the same things. And I think that's the reality of it, certainly for us, as our bereavement path has led us, is that your life takes a completely different direction. You'll never be the same again, and you learn to adapt. I think people talk about moving on, but it's more adaption we find.
In terms of stages of grief, I went to see a bereavement counsellor who was recommended to me, and I remember her producing a piece of paper with what the so-called stages of bereavement on, and I remember most of all that the photocopy was at a slight angle, and I thought, you know, I matter this much that they can't give me a proper photocopy. And she went through these stages, and I would just say to anybody who's given something like that, put it in the bin, put it on the fire. I think the best analogy I've got for myself about grief is that there was a ride at Alton Towers years and years ago, I don't know if it's still there. You go into a big building, you climb some stairs, you get strapped into a roller coaster car, and then the lights go out, and you have no idea where it's going to go, and it's pitch black, and that's what it's like. And the forces are doing this to you, and it's absolutely terrifying. You just have no control over it. That's what it's like.
And you feel incredibly helpless. And the first year, I was just barking as a box of frogs. You know, I was presenting myself as being perfectly rational, having coped with things, but I was completely bonkers. And I had 2 little girls who were 9 and 10 then to look out for and look after, and that's what probably kept me on the straight and narrow, you know, just about. But you do, you lose it. And I think we should just, in the West, learn to let go and let God and let things out and weep and mourn and wail, you know, and just get it out there, man.
Francis, I can feel you seething next to me when I even mentioned stages of grief.
Yeah, well, textbooks aren't really useful, actually, are they, honestly, because it doesn't work that way. But there is one story that I've always remembered. I can't remember who told me originally, but it's a custom that Red Indians have. Maybe some of you know it. If a member of the family dies, the Red Indian, I think it's men's grief, actually, as I recall, a man will go out into the forest with an axe, and he'll choose a tree, and he actually hacks a great sort of piece out of the trunk of the tree, and then he just sits at the foot of the tree. And at intervals, he'll go back to that tree, his tree, and the scar will forever be there. It will never be the same as it was. But the character of the scar changes. It, you know, it's not the same. It changes, but it's always there.
Weathers.
Yeah, weathers, yeah.
Could I just ask each of you what we talked to a lot of sort of negative things, but how you've got to the point that you can stand on a stage and talk to these wonderful people about your experiences? What organisations or individuals or comments have really helped you?
I am so grateful for this lady sat on the end of the stage here, because Sister Frances is one of the many people that have helped us on our journey, really, and I think she's said it so elegantly. And I don't know if Sister Frances remembers this, but our first meeting, we'd come for our first stay at Helen House, and I was very keen to meet Frances. And I think it was about 8 o'clock in the morning when we got on a knock on the door, and I was still in my boxer shorts, and somebody said, Sister Frances is coming up to see you now. So... And that was our first... Yeah, thanks. Sorry about that, Nick. But and I just love, you know, Frances, because, you know, you know she's done amazing things, but she's still a human and she's still very down to earth. And I think that's all I would say, is just be yourselves when you come across bereaved people. Don't pretend to be anything that you're not. Another organisation that helped us was the Child Bereavement Charity. And for those of you that might come across that charity, there's a lady there called Jenny Thomas, who again founded the charity out of seeing the need of bereaved families. And she sat there just like a mum. And I think we'd tried the whole kind of bereavement counselling episode through our local government-funded bereavement counselling service. I still remember it very clearly. The lady that was supposedly counselling me came up the stairs, kind of crashed into the room, huffed and puffed. She was quite a large lady, huffed and puffed, and then proceeded to tell me what a bad day she'd had. and then having, you know, this was within weeks of me losing Misha. I was kicked off the course, having not been able to attend it 2 or 3 times because I couldn't face going to the sessions. Jenny Thomas came along and sat in front of us. And for the first time, we were able to talk about things together. And she actually said, look, just, you know, what is it, Pete, that you feel? What is it, Rach, that you feel? And together we were started to come and do our grief together. And I think the misconception that a lot of people have is that, having been married at that point for probably nearly 15 years, that would be the case, that our bereavement would be very similar. But actually we found that male and female grief is so different, and to accept and understand and acknowledge that. So.
Rachel, do you want to... Sorry, just pick something.
We'll fight you for it. Lots of people that we've spoken to have said that they only truly feel comfortable in the presence of people that have been there before, and actually that it just helps to talk to other people that have walked the same path that you have walked, and I would say that was true. I would also say that it doesn't always take professional counsellors, and the friend who is willing to listen and have a cup of tea with you is often the person that makes the biggest difference.
We had a bit of professional counselling and it was really rubbish, actually, myself and the girls. And it's because everybody's journey is different. Everybody's journey is completely different. And you learn to work it out as you go along. And, you know, a husband and wife can marry again. A mother or father can never have that child back. A daughter or son can never regain their mum or father. So everybody's journey is different. Who God sends is interesting. And who leaves you is interesting. People have been very close to you and your wife while your wife was alive, gone. People who you've not known very well suddenly come forward and they shoulder the burden. And they carry you. And my experience was that the community at Chorley Wood, where we live, and the church, and but also these businesses.